The Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello, welcome to The Commentary Track. For the purposes of this episode, let's just say that I'm Frank Thompson, your host. Just go with that and nobody gets hurt. Got a great episode tonight with my friend Patricia King Hansen. If you are a fan of the AFI catalog, and I don't know many film buffs or film historians who don't have those volumes or at least coveted those volumes, Patricia King Hansen was for many years the editor of that incredible collection of research. And now still works on it in a freelance capacity. Robert S. Burchard is now the head honcho there at the AFI catalog. But Pat was there for a long time, and she was in charge of making it the wondrous font of information that it was and is. It's now available online at AFI.com, and it's really great to have it, although sentimentally I miss my huge red volumes that took up several feet of shelf space. But I do like having it online. And the good thing about it being online is that they are now updating entries and adding new entries, and it's just an ongoing project that continues to get better and better all the time. This was one of the first interviews I did for the Commentary Track, and the reason it hasn't aired before now is because I was never happy with the sound quality of it. For some reason, it sounded as if we had recorded it in a vast cathedral, which I assure you we did not. It had just an echoey quality to it, and I don't know exactly how to account for that. I am not one of the world's great audio engineers, although I do think I'm in the top five, obviously. But I never could really get it to sound as sharp as I would like. So I decided that I enjoyed the interview so much that I was going to put it on with that caveat. And it's just a matter of your monkeying with your own volume when you listen to it. I think it'll be fine. But it's just so much fun hearing what Pat has to say. And this is very much like conversations that she and I have on semi-regular occasions. Just get together and talk movies. But she'll give us some background on how she got started and how she got in with the AFI and what the process was there. And what she's been doing since. And it's all really interesting stuff. And we have a lot of the same points of view on a lot of things, but we diverge here and there. But that just makes for interesting conversation, says I. So I do hope that you will enjoy it. And there's one element that we talked about in the conversation. And I just, as I was re-listening to it today, it occurred to me that we were prescient, or else we just had one of our wishes come true, kind of. I was discussing a film called Margie, a 1946 Henry King film with the wondrous Gene Crane, and how much I like it and how that's going to be the subject of one of my location jaunts one of these days. And the conversation turned to, boy, wouldn't it be great if Fox started doing like Warner Brothers Archive is doing and releasing films as movies on demand for titles that they don't think have a great deal of commercial potential, but they feel like there's something of following out there. And lo and behold, in the last few months, Fox has done just that. They've started releasing a limited number of titles as movies on demand. I think you can go to oldies.com. I think you might even be able to get them on the Warner Brothers site where the Warner Archive stuff is. And it's worth checking out. I'm sad to say that Margie is not among that first group, nor is a bunch of other ones that I would love to see from Fox. For instance, Henry King's I'd Climb the Highest Mountain, another favorite film of mine. Still, it's a great start, very encouraging, and I hope other studios will take the hint. Are you listening, Universal, with your early Paramount films that we have not really had access to in any way for years and years and years? Because I think that would be a good way to go, too. But I digress, don't I? As I often do. So I hope you'll enjoy this interview with Patricia King Hansen, and I will see you on the other side. As long as I've known you, you've worked for the AFI, mm-hmm. and you really go way back with the AFI, don't you? What, how did, let's go with that first.
Well, I actually started at AFI in 1983. And when I retired, I was one day short of being there 26 years, as they pointed out. So I wasn't really there 26 years, but I was one day short. Right. And I'd like to say I was just a mere slip of a girl when I started. But I had had some jobs before then and had actually been a historian. I was in graduate school for medieval and Italian history and also got a library degree and worked at USC in the reference department. Then went for a publisher who published a book called McGill's Survey of Cinema. And then started working at AFI, and that was my last, and will be my last full-time job for many, many years.
So it sounded like you didn't really come to it as a movie buff, per se.
Well,
or did you?
I didn't have the training of it, but I have to say that going back to my early childhood, when the local station in L.A., KHJ, would have the million-dollar movie on TV, I would stay up so late to see that when I was just a little kid. My parents were always angry, and I'd always say, yeah, I'm turning the TV off, or I'm not listening, and then I'd sneak up and watch more. And whenever I was home from school, I think they used to have an afternoon movie, too, and I was just addicted to those. And anyone who was raised in L.A. and is of a certain age will remember that it wasn't just Channel 9, but I think Channel 5 and Channel 11, Channel 13 all showed old movies. And so I just grew up loving those. And I had an older brother and sister who would take me to the movies in Westchester, the Loyola and the Paradise. The premises are still there, but neither one of them are our theaters, although you still see the Loyola Theater in commercials. I think it's now an office building or something. And so I really had a love of old movies. So when I was working at USC, I started doing some work for a publisher and mentioned, you know, they really need to have more movie reference books. And so I started to work for him, and then through that was able to hear about the AFI job after a few years. And so I wasn't professionally trained, but I always had a love of it, even since I was, you know, maybe 3 years old and saw Fred Astaire's Dancing on the Ceiling and in Royal Wedding, which is actually about the first movie I remember people, you know, the family getting in the car and going to see the movie. Mm. I'm sure I'd seen movies before then, but I do remember that as a major experience of my young life.
Yeah, I've often thought that it was kind of significant that the very first movie I ever saw in a theater was actually a revival, which was Snow White, which was a re-release when I was, I guess, 6 years old or something like that. So I actually started out my life with a movie that was made well before I was born. But
yeah, I mean, it's funny when you talk to people, especially film historians, like, what is the first movie you remember seeing? Or, you know, often we don't remember the very first we saw, but something that was very early in your childhood. And a lot of times that really started people on the road to loving films the rest of their lives, really.
Yeah.
I grew up in an area, well, although I was raised in L.A., my parents had a summer house in Northern California, and it was on a river, there was no TV there or anything, and so the little local community would show old movies twice a week for free outside. And I think the, whatever was the equivalent to the Homeowners Association, didn't want to spend a lot. So we had a lot of black and white movies from the 30s and 40s and old serials and things like that. So that was another thing that I remember seeing a lot when I was a young kid. And then we would go to the local theaters a lot too. In the summer, they would change the bill at least three times a week. So in the 50s, I really saw a lot. You know, whether I went with my parents because it was someplace you had to drive to, or my older brother and sister who could also drive were dragging me along. I saw plenty of those movies.
It really seems like just the way TV was at the time, especially until at least the mid-60s, it was as much black and white as color on television. And so when they showed old movies, it didn't really seem much out of step with everything else that was on TV. And so as a kid, I'd never really made that much of a differentiation.
Yeah, it didn't for me either. And the funny thing is, even once in a while now, I will see a movie, an older movie, and not realize, oh, that was in color, you know, because I remember seeing it when I was a kid when it was in black and white. And I don't think we had a color TV until at least the mid to late 60s. So everything was black as far as I was concerned.
Yeah, I remember when kids that I knew started getting color TVs, which was well before I got one, that The Wizard of Oz came on television in color, which I didn't get to see. But it was a subject of great discussion the next day at school. And it was generally concluded that they had invented Technicolor after the movie started being shot.
So that's why they have the
So it starts off in black and white, and then, oh, we've invented Technicolor. Let's continue from here on in color.
Yeah, it's funny how kids come up with these very logical reasons for something that does make sense.
When Alfalfa Switzer was killed, I was in the first grade, and we, on the playground, determined that apparently Butch had done it, because who else would be mean enough to kill Alfalfa, right?
Yeah, and the Little Rascals were on TV, or, you know, I know those of us who remember them from way back and studying things remember this, our gang, that on TV they were always the Little Rascals, so they were sure on TV a lot when we were kids, and I remember seeing all those things, so I don't recall wondering who did it. that, again, could make perfect sense.
Those were kind of gateway films to me to early sound cinema, because we saw Laurel and Hardy almost every day on kids' afternoon shows, and our gang comedies, Little Rascals. And so you would see these 1929 shorts, and because they were Laurel and Hardy and our gang, they were fine. We liked them. And so I think when I first started seeing early sound dramatic films, it didn't seem like that much of a leap to me. It was almost like I'd been adjusted. Whereas I think if you got a kid today who had never seen a 1929 talkie and showed it to him, it would seem very alien in style.
It was, you know? It would seem very stilted to them.
Yeah.
I do remember, like, during the school year when we lived in our regular house, we would go to the Saturday matinees, and even in the 50s, even the late 50s, a lot of times they would show these old serials and shorts from the 30s and 40s to accompany, you know, whether it's Spirit of St. Louis or, you know, some movie that we were going to see, or some kids' kind of movie that we were going to see. So I think the studios, or at least the exhibitors, really got a lot of mileage out of those things when you think of it, that, you know, looking back at it now, it's like, oh, okay, so Robert Benchley died in 1945, but I remember seeing some of his stuff in the theaters in the mid-50s and just thinking, you know, yeah, he's somebody who's still around. They just made
exactly. It always puzzles me when I'll mention something to somebody and they'll say, well, that was made before I was born, right? I always think, well, gosh, most of the things I like, W.C. Fields was dead before I was even born. There's a lot of people. I mean, Robert Benchley, too.
Yeah, there's
dead before I even started living.
Yes.
And yet, and yet I like them, you know?
Yeah, I think there's a... In some ways, I do think people are more used to seeing things and appreciating things from the past in the 21st century than we were maybe in the early 50s, because when you, even looking at stars like Jack Nicholson or Robert Redford, and they're certainly not of the first tier any longer, they're older, but they're still recognized figures, they're still considered big stars, and yet they became stars in the 1960s and 70s, whereas in the 50s, there were no stars around who were big stars from the 20s or the teens. You know, they had all kind of disappeared. There were a few people who were still acting, but, you know, you would never say, oh, yeah, that Douglas Fairbanks, or, you know, these people weren't still around. So I think because of seeing things on TV and on DVD and Blu-ray now, that maybe more people who like films are able to expand their horizons a little bit. And also just the general public, I think, because of the way things are, people do stay in the public eye a little bit more than they than they used to.
It seems like a lot of the people from the 20s who were still working in the 50s and 60s tended to be supporting actors on TV. Like Zazu Pitts was in
Susanna. Yeah.
And a lot of there was a lot of that going on.
Yeah. And even Gilbert Rolland was still around.
Yeah.
Way after that even.
Yeah, you would see a lot of those people and still when you're watching like an Andy Griffith show or something like that, you'll see like just somebody, some obscure character actor from the teens or 20s will show up as an old lady or something. And
It is funny that like Robert Warwick or someone who was a huge star in the teens and the 20s and then, you know, did sort of supporting things in the 30s and 40s, and he was still around quite late but doing these sort of smaller parts. But the sort of bigger stars is what I meant.
Yeah.
Were really not on anybody's radar any longer.
No, we didn't grow up with first-hand knowledge of Lillian Gish or Mary Pickford or any of those people, because they weren't working in, or Lillian Gish was still doing supporting things well into the 60s, I guess, but not much until, I guess, Wales of August, when which was the last hurrah for a lot of those.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that how short those people's careers were. As I was talking with Rudy Belmer earlier about Clara Bow and how he
had a little bit of a
correspondence with her in the 60s when he was doing an article about her. And he said, nobody really remembered who she was at all. I mean, she just was not on the public radar, and yet enormous.
And even her last film, I think, was Caller Savage.
Or Hoopla, maybe.
Was it one of those two, you know, 32, 33, whatever. She was only in her...
Late 20s, yeah.
Yeah, in her 20s.
26 or 27, yeah.
And yet she... Those were fairly well-regarded and well-received films, but she just quit kind of cold turkey. I think that was one of the things with her. But yeah, when my son, who's in his early 30s, had seen a couple of her films. So she was adorable. You know, what happened to her? And I said, well, it's a long story. And sadly, when you look at some of the stories of people who just totally disappeared, even though she was alive and for many, many decades after that, it can be kind of sad. I think that it is very sad being a film historian sometimes. Even when somebody has a long and happy life, when they die, you feel kind of a personal loss. I always do when I'm reading
him. Well, even Kevin Brownlow talks about how when he first started interviewing people in the 60s, that they tended to think, well, weren't our films ridiculous, or wouldn't they be kind of stupid for people to look at today? And I think there really was an almost concerted effort to make the silent era seem absurd, because we had a lot of things that joked about them, that fractured flickers and those kind of things on TV that would put funny narration and funny sound effects.
Yeah, I think that's completely true, and I don't know if that was because people, you know, like sometimes people get wealthy who started from nothing and they don't want to hear about their past, and maybe there was some sort of similarity in that. But also, you know, obviously, as you know better than me, the speed that they were shown.
Yeah.
On television or in the movies, it was speeded up, so even a dramatic movie made it look ridiculous, like it was a Keystone Cop chase or something like that. And people just didn't have this tradition, the narrative tradition of a silent film, so that's another thing. And, you know, the makeup was a little different and the lighting and everything, so I think it is very difficult for some people to really get into the mode of saying, oh, this is the way silent films were. You really have to get used to them or be very open-minded to love them. But that certainly seems very similar to what I have heard of people of that era talking about, oh, we were sure corny, you know. Oh, I was at a screening of a way down east. And there were a couple of actresses there, this was a number of years ago, who had been in silent films, and I think one who had even acted in one of Griffith's films. And after the screening, several of us who were younger, well, that was the most wonderful film, and they were all, boy, even the old master was sure corny, and the, you know, the, they thought it was really hokum, so it was quite a revelation. That they wouldn't look back and say, "Oh yes, that was most wonderful."
Yeah, it's kind of sad in a way because it's almost like, well, I noticed this in general, in life in general, that there's this tendency to regard anything in the past as being slightly absurd. I mean, take any person you know, and show them their own yearbook of when they were, say, a junior in high school. And their immediate reaction will be shame or shock.
What a geek.
Can you believe we dressed like that? Can you believe I looked like that? And it's an interesting phenomenon to me that we seem to live every moment as though, okay, now we're fine, but up to now, we've just been ridiculous.
Yeah, I think there's kind of a feeling... perhaps amongst women, that they look at their photos and they say, you know, 35 is perfect age. It's when you're mature, but you haven't gotten old yet.
Well, that's a good idea. You know. But, yeah, it's just curious. And so I'm always glad that older films are getting any kind of... today, in some ways, older films are being treated with more respect, at least... institutionally than ever before. I mean, to see all these great restorations, and I just saw the Wings restoration at, I saw it twice last week, and it's magnificent, and it's better than I've ever seen it, and I've seen it many, many times over my life, and so in some miraculous way, we're living in a golden age for these things.
Oh, we certainly are. And I didn't see that. I'd seen it a couple of years ago when it was at the Academy, and I had seen it before and seen it since, but I was really blown away by it then, and the audience seemed really blown away by it as well, especially that scene where Gary Cooper comes on screen, and many people didn't know that he was in it, and they were just speechless with how gorgeous he was. But yeah, so many of them are restored, and I find actually... because now I'm very concentrated on late 20s films particularly, and seeing a lot that I'd never seen before, that the more I see, the more I have an appreciation, even for some of the films that weren't maybe the top-tiered films. Things that had actors who were very charismatic, but maybe they just didn't get to be up with Barrymore or Douglas Fairbanks or someone like that. The stories, I think... you have to really get yourself into a mindset that you're not going to... You know, now you could, let's say, turn the television on to one of the cable stations, see a movie that's been with them the last 5 years. It will take you several minutes sometimes to figure out what the film is because there's so much time taken with every shot and, you know, so many long sweeping scenes. In the silent era, when films were... shorter, and even in the 30s and 40s, they just got to it. You don't have time to linger on things. You have to present the story, you have to act out with the body, and, you know, as the 20s went on, as you know, they had more intertitles to explain things, but even so, they just got to the story a lot faster. So you could cover a period of 20 years in 65 minutes, and for modern audiences who are used to everything being kind of laid out and taking a long time and so forth, I think that's a little bit difficult for them to grasp. Like, well, what's the backstory here? We want to know the backstory. Well, you know, you're just sort of assuming.
Yeah.
You know, I remember when we were working on that AFI catalog from 1911 to 1920, we would see reviews and they would always end with something like, and then the hero and the gal got married and lived happily ever after. Well, if you saw that film... they didn't actually show you that. They just would have the sweetheart smiling at the hero or something. Mm-hmm. But everybody just sort of filled in their own backstory, and there was nothing that anybody would dispute on that. So of course that happened. You know, sure. You didn't see it on screen, but everybody knew that's what had happened. So you had this kind of mindset that you could fill in the blanks on things, whereas now I don't think you get a lot of blanks that you have to fill in most films, because even if it takes place over the course of 1 or 2 days, it's a really 2.5 hours of film. They really give you a lot there.
I've often thought about this because I like movies. I mean, I like modern movies. I go to see all the new releases, and I like them. I mean, there are in several movies out right now that I just love. But it's very rare that I want to see a new movie again. And I've thought about that many times because I wonder, why did I enjoy it so much? And then I just feel like I've seen that. Whereas there are other movies that I can watch, movies from the 30s or so forth, that I've seen a dozen times or
oh,
more.
Me too. Yeah.
And I think it's that very thing that in movies today, everything is laid out to such an extent that there's nothing left for us. You know, once it's over with, we get it. We know what's happened. And there are so many other movies that there's things between the lines, and there are moments that engage our imagination, and so it's we can return to it again and again. I don't know exactly what it is.
I think you're right, because there are movies that I do see more than once that are newer movies, but usually it's because I like a particular star, or their performance was so great, or there's something that really, you know, beautiful scenery or something that touches me. But yeah, there are very few movies where if you get it the first time, you need to get it again. Whereas in a lot of the films, especially from the 30s and the 20s, you can pick up little nuances, or you can make up your own nuances, and you can still keep watching it and enjoy it. And, you know, it's like looking at an American Primitive painting. Now, some people don't like those. I personally like those.
Oh, I do, yes.
And it's like, well, no, it's not because they couldn't draw any better. It's because that's the style. When I was in medieval history and taking art as some of the classes, although that wasn't my specialty, some of the kids would say, oh, you know, they were so dumb, they didn't draw very well in the Middle Ages and this, that, and the other thing. And I remember one of my professors saying the radical idea that people could always draw well. It was the time and the experience, whatever, that made them draw that well. If we had a time machine to go back and teach one of these people to draw, who was a great artist from the 13th century, they would do just as good a job as somebody later. It was just, that's the way things were. And in a way, I think it's like that with silent films. They had many different traditions going on, and now we have different traditions going on, and it's just the way you view them. And the same thing with 30s films. I know younger people who worked with me at the catalog, or people that I, you know, my son or nieces and nephews, or things who will watch these films, are like, well, how did you get that out of it? And say, oh, well, see, that's because, you know, in the 30s they were doing such and such and such and such. Whereas now, you don't need to know the backstory because it kind of fills you in with everything.
Yeah, there was a kind of code, not like production code, but like
secret handshake code.
That you understood things when you saw a woman wearing a tweed suit and glasses. She was a lesbian. They never said she was, but you knew that because of you just knew it. There's a certain thing, you know. There's all sorts of little things like that for instances that they didn't want to come right out with. Even during the pre-code time, they were still
trying to be tasteful.
Yeah, not only tasteful, but it was still a time to be sly, not a time to be overt.
And I think you find that even in the literature too. If you read Hemingway and Fitzgerald and, you know, just any number of authors, both American and English authors or Italian authors that I'm familiar with, they didn't really go in for giving you every bit of information and not only filling in the blanks, but being very graphic about things. They just sort of described things, and it was left for you to understand what was going on then.
Yeah. It's it's interesting how much we like the pre-code films, or I'm saying we. I mean,
I definitely do.
When obviously we can see films in which literally anything can be depicted, and often is. So it's not like we are starved for something a little risque or something like that, but it's just the wit and the style in which they were able to suggest things that went away after the code for a long time because they just couldn't even make those suggestions. But there's just something so fun about that.
How they got around. I mean, I think Billy Wilder said, you know, a few years before he died, you know, I didn't like the code, but it made us more clever.
Yeah.
We had to get around certain things. And so it was kind of a, you know, Monty Python-esque wink, wink, nudge, nudge. You know what I'm talking about,
sure.
Even though we're not explicitly saying that. And now when you look at those films, and you do have to be a little bit knowledgeable about the era and about filmmaking stuff, and even about the culture of the time, you can see, so that's what they meant. And they really are very clever compared to just saying, okay, well, this is what happened.
You can sometimes think back on films that were regarded as completely scandalous at the time, like Babyface with Barbara Stanwyck, which to 1933 audiences seemed really at the edge of what a decent film could...
That was probably one of the ones that put it over the edge.
But of course, when you see it today, it does seem very forthright, but it also does not seem very obvious. It seems you can certainly see what's happening, but it's done in such a clever way that there's no kid in the world who couldn't watch it safely, you know, and not get anything negative out of it. But it's a great line that those guys knew how to walk. I heard John Wayne being interviewed about it one time, and he said something like, he was mentioning the Lubitsch films. He said he was able to do it in such a way that if you had the experience, you could understand what it was, but if you hadn't, it just seemed like something else. And that's a gift. That's a really interesting...
It is. And people like Barbara Stanwyck, Ruth Chatterton,
mm-hmm.
who, you know, not people know, not unless you really are through this person. But, I mean, they did push the envelope. And
sure, female. I mean, it was quite a risque film.
And both of them made several films that, I think, you know, Night Nurse and, you know, different things that kind of pushed the envelope. But interestingly, I think they also would be considered today very feminist films. And I think when the code came in, there wasn't a lot of that. You know, it changed quite a bit that women could no longer be overtly sexual, even if they didn't even use that word in the film. So it did change things a lot. And it was kind of a little... maybe paternalistic view of things, in my opinion, but they could show women and men having adult relationships. They didn't have to actually show them in bed, but you knew they had been to bed, and mm-hmm. I think that was probably a big difference. That later on, there might have been the implication, but you couldn't actually say that they were, unless you get an occasion where a woman is pregnant, like to each his own or something like that, and then she suffers for it the rest of her life. So you get a lot of those things. And there were very few films in which they actually do, I mean, relatively few films in which they actually do say, yes, these people slept together and they had a child, where they didn't suffer in one way or another throughout the end of the film. So I think that did make a little bit of a difference.
It's funny, even in the silent days, there was a lot of that going on. There was, of course, the silent films seem to enjoy suffering more than sound films. They enjoyed the heroine who had to go through trials of sometimes extreme sorts.
You're just like, oh my gosh, what else can happen? I mean, even some of the bigger, like way down east, it's like, my God, what that woman went through.
Yeah.
And then
no fault of her own. Yes.
Yeah. You know, a very common thing, especially in sort of the lower level on the quality scale films, you know, these things from Sierra Pictures and some of these places, the poor hero's farm is lost and all these things happen and he's cheated out of this, that, and the other thing, and at the end he finally gets his comeuppance, usually by having a fist fight with the bad guy or something, but it's just like, how could all that stuff happen? I was just reading about one today in which the guy's racehorse was disqualified by somebody doing something to it, and it was a bad guy. He goes home to his farm, and it turns out his mother has just recently gone blind, and, you know, just what else can happen? And that, I think that really goes back to a lot of 19th century melodrama kind of thing, that this was a really popular thing. People liked those sort of sob stories. Now we have reality TV.
Yeah, same thing. Except we're asked to pretend that it's actually happening.
Yeah.
When in fact it's not actually happening any more than it happened to Lillian Gish. But, you bring up another interesting point to me, is that we do think of different periods having different styles, but in fact there's kind of a continuum that goes right through the whole history of drama, that you know, when we first start making moving pictures, everybody always talks about how the expressions are more exaggerated and bigger and all that. That's really a stage convention, mm-hmm. more than a movie convention. It was people acting like they were in a play and playing to the back of the theater, and all the big, oversized, operatic...
The grand gestures.
Yeah, grand gestures. Really, when you get right down to it, that goes away pretty fast in movies. I mean, by the mid-teens, it's really... You don't see it all that much. It shows up now and again. But by the 20s, people are acting pretty normally throughout. And
interesting. I think when you get to that early transition to sound... There was a little bit of a regression because they felt that they had to project. I don't think it was ever as bad as one of my favorite musicals, Singing in the Rain.
No.
But you do see it. I unfortunately, the name escapes me right now, but the first complete drawing room sort of drama that Paramount did, that was with William Powell. And William Powell had a wonderful speaking voice. He was a very light actor. And yet he was emoting and pronouncing everything so well that it just didn't even sound like him. Mm-hmm. And yet the reviews were quite positive about it. But I think people were expecting, okay, well, we have to change our mode a little bit here and then go to it. But then other times you'll find, even in the same year, something that's a little bit lighter, it doesn't have that kind of emoting look. You know, another tradition that, in addition to the melodrama and the musicals, you know, Chautauqua... That people would go into these tents and have teaching experiences and lectures and stuff. So a lot of films had that experiences as well. But I did want to touch on something you said about things, the dramatic heritage. When we were doing the catalog, initially we were doing decade by decade. And although the 20s and 60s were done before I got there, we started the teens. And we could tell, because in the teens decade, we pretty much had one person doing a year, and then if they finished, they'd go into another year. So you could really tell a difference between 1913 and 14 and 1919. And then, you know, it's like we went into the 30s, because the 20s had been gone, and then it was just like culture shock of how things had changed. You know, oh my God, people are talking, things like that. And then we went to the 40s and the 50s, and we noticed, like, it almost was like, okay, December 31st, 1940, things are going to change. Now, tomorrow we're going to have our films be such. It wasn't quite as cut and dried, but you really do notice when you're studying them decade by decade, and then you just move on to the next decade, how much things really did change. It certainly was more subtle than we felt, but it's almost like we've closed the books on that, like we're starting something new. And each era had their, you know, not only what kind of stars there were, but what kind of stories were popular, what emotions and that kind of thing. So it gave us kind of an interesting perspective on things, how the decades were changing over the years.
It does. When you when you refer to the teens or the 20s or the 30s, the assumptions you're making about those are pretty accurate. I mean, there was a kind of 30s style that was different from the 20s style, that was different from the 40s style. And that goes with styles of acting as well as styles of filmmaking. And
even just clothes and makeup.
Yeah.
And however they did that, they just... You can... And I'm sure you could do this better than I, but you turn on the TV and even not knowing what the film is, or maybe there might be sort of a scene where you don't even see any actually. You can almost tell what decade it's from or within pretty close proximity just by looking at it. Whereas I think once you got into the color era, you can still do it, but it's a little bit harder. For some reason, that black and white transitions, to me, it was a little bit easier to say, okay, well, it's this decade or that.
I think in the 30s, I might be able to tell you which year it is if I just see something, just turn something on and look at it. I think I could tell the difference between 1936 and 37.
Yeah, that's a pretty good subtle difference to make. But yeah, you can sort of see how things are different. So now maybe 20 years from now, I'll look back and say, you know, back in the aughts of the 20s, you could really tell the difference between things. But at least in perspective now, it seems like you could tell a little bit.
Yeah,
what's going on.
It is a funny kind of cultural blindness that we have to our own time. Because if somebody said to me that a movie from 2001 looks different from a movie from 2012, I would think, really? Does it? I mean, is it that different? But probably it does. I mean, probably there's enough of a just a different point of view. I mean, there's a way films are shot and what we now expect from an establishing shot or a movie opening or... Mm-hmm. Anything like that. It's constantly changing, and it's interesting that it does. And it's only when you get a certain amount of distance, like a movie from 1982 is very clearly different in style and tone.
Oh, yeah.
And just the lighting, just the way movies are lit is very different. And when done right, lovely in its way, but it's different from now and different from earlier. And that's when you start looking now at the movies from, say, the early 70s, or what I like to call pre-Jaws, where everything changed. But the first 4 years of the 70s, there's a great look to all those films. I mean, The Godfather and Chinatown. And,
oh, yeah. No,
and it's just a very classical look to them that... I think at the time when I was I was then in my 20s, it all seemed really new and radical, and it was a different way of shooting. You know, The Godfather seemed like a different kind of film, and now it seems very classical
of all the films post, say, 1950. That I like, I'd say The Godfather and Chinatown are two of my absolute of all time. And I remember when The Godfather opened in Westwood, they had these huge lines. I mean, that's sort of a different aspect of the whole exhibition thing, but it was just playing at the one theater, and people would literally go at 2 o'clock in the morning because it's showing it around the clock, and you would have to wait in line for hours. And I think there was even an article in the LA Times, I'm pretty sure it was at Times or LA Magazine, about, you know, don't break in line into somebody's line if you don't want your arm broken. Because people were so obsessed with seeing that. It was a huge event. And it wasn't just because there was a lot of violence or there were attractive stars or something. It was, I think people knew even then, this is something special. This is something that's going to change a lot. Very often, you know, we see things from the past and we look and say, wow, that was a great movie. But at the time, it was just sort of like, here's another movie. But other times, there are films that they say, okay, this is going to change things, and you can recognize it at the time, and you recognize it now. This is going to be something that's going to be really something.
I think a perfect example of that to me is the Wild Bunch, that I went and saw that and came out a different person. You know, it was like everything changed because it was a different, and I still regard it as one of my favorite movies ever, but it's just, it was just different in every way. I mean, the whole aspect of it was different. And I don't know how you feel about that film, but I always find it ironic that people always single out the violence in the film as being one of the primary characteristics of it, where I don't think it is at all. It's such an elegiac, melancholy film.
Yeah, you know, I agree. Actually,
so beautiful.
I've never seen that on the big screen.
Ooh.
The time that that came out, I was frittering my life away reading about medieval history in graduate school, so, and was extremely poor. So I didn't actually see a lot of movies in the theater from about 1967 to 71, because I was really concentrating on my ancient medieval studies and also just really broke. So, you know, unless I met somebody who wanted to take me to movies, I didn't go to too many of them. But then I've seen a lot of those since then. And I really like, I have a copy of that. Since my son loves it. It's one of his favorite films, too. But I really look at that and I think, how could people write against that film? It's such a great film. And you say it really changes you. And I think there aren't that many films. You could see a great film, like you mentioned, Singing in the Rain. I love that film. Sure. I don't say it changed me. It doesn't change you. But you just love it because it's such an entertaining, charming film. And others, you see it, and you just think that just it does really change the way you look at things or change the way films are made, whatever.
Yes, I think Singing in the Rain is a perfect example of something that if you had gone to see it in 1952, that you probably would have come out saying, hey, good movie, where do you want to eat, you know?
Yeah.
And I think only over time do we realize, wow, this is just perfect in every detail. And it's perfect in a way that, to my mind, none of the other MGM musicals is perfect. I like a lot of them, but I don't love many of them. They're all what they are, and I like musical numbers, and, you know, there's usually a certain kind of cut and driedness about the plots and everything, but they're fine. I mean, I like them, but this one is, for whatever reason, it just elevates itself out of the
out of the
rank and file.
You can just see a film sometimes, and it just hits all the marks.
Yeah,
and then you know, find yourself humming the songs or thinking of little scenes of it or repeating lines or whatever. And that certainly is is one. I think I'm probably a little bit more pro MGM musicals than but I'd say that is probably my favorite. And, you know, I like things like Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, I think, is right up there with me, which is certainly enjoyable, but I don't think it's gotten quite the acclaim that Singing in the Rain is, or Gigi or something like
that. There's something wonderful about all of them. I mean, there's usually some number or some choreography or something. I mean, certainly Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, you can't beat it for the
Enthusiastic dance.
And good songs. I mean, it's generally, I don't love the movie. I like it, but it's, and
the movies, the musicals that don't really stand, and musicals aren't my favorite genre, but the ones that don't really stand up too much for me are even though I like the actors, are those Fox musicals of the 40s. You know, Betty Grable and Alice Faye. They were certainly charming people, great voices, beautiful technicolor and things like that. And individual numbers can be great, but for some reason they just don't do it for me. And whatever else. Whereas, you know, of course, I love the Busby Berkeley musicals. Those are certainly.
We, there are a bunch of friends and I have a Thursday night movie night and get together in a friend's garage theater. And somebody brought over just a reel of Fox musical numbers a few weeks ago. And so it was almost an hour and a half, I guess, of just one number after another from Shirley Temple on through The Gang's All Here and everything. And you look at those number by number and you think, wow, these are terrific. And
they had great individual numbers.
But then you watch the entire movies and less so. There's almost no movie that's a full experience like Singing in the Rain is.
Yeah.
But individually, you can be fooled into... I remember I was watching... this is a tangent, I guess, but I was watching Kevin Brownlow's Cinema Europe series one time, and was watching the episode on Scandinavian films, and just incredibly beautiful from start to finish. Every one of these clips, I just think, I want to see this. And I was talking to somebody else, and he said, yeah, Kevin really knows how to pick the right clip.
So, that happens.
Yeah.
It's like, I guess, when actor, director, producer watches the dailies, and they think, wow, this is great. Every daily is perfect. And then you put them all together, and yeah. I just turn out terrible.
But still, I would still like to see a lot of those Scandinavian films, nonetheless. But, now, when you... First, you started with McGill's Survey of the Cinema, and then went on to the AFI. So, did you start studying movies, or did you just become more honed in on film at that time?
Both. As I say, I had always really loved movies and had watched a lot of them. I mean, it used to, as I say, my parents thought I would come to nothing if I pursued that, and so I pursued other things. And, you know, amongst my friends, they was always like, oh, well, let's call Pat, because I'm sure she knows who this actor is, or whatever kind of thing. And I had a very dog-eared copy of Ephraim Katz, the film encyclopedia that, you know, was the Bible, and then there was Leonard Maltin's TV movies, which is, you know, I had two Bibles to live by. So I did have to really immerse myself more in it when I went to AFI. And when I was at McGill's, too, I've never taken a class in film, although I've actually taught some since then.
But,
you know, I really did find that, whereas before I had some books on it, that I would buy more books and I would study. And I never really thought of my job as being the editor and project manager of the AFI catalog. It was just being a job. It was always really a life choice. So for me, it was really an immersion. And then... You know, allied with that, I did a lot of other books with my husband. And also, you know, we did film reviews. And, you know, over the last 30 years, I've done a lot of other things film related, even with you, Frank.
I want to talk about that. That's an interesting experience. Go ahead.
But I did find that I couldn't just watch them. I had to read them and really get immersed in them. So I did find that, you know, I would be doing the work during the week, but then on the weekends, a lot of times I would watch movies that other people were cataloging and try and spot character actors. So I would read up on things. And, of course, now since my retirement, I spend a lot of time doing that. And with the Internet, having so many primary sources available, which is... absolutely great. You know, I'm just really enjoying that. And also think, wow, if we'd only had this when we were doing the teens or the 30s, it would have not only saved us time, but a lot of little things where we might have a little note where it might say, you know, sources conflict on this, that, and the other thing. Now we get a lot of primary sources. I'm able to find a lot of primary sources and say, aha, so that's, you know, that's what happened.
I just found out that Box Office Magazine is online archived from 1920 on. Every page, just the entire...
Yeah, I actually haven't
amazing.
Used it online, but I had heard that as well. I love having Film Daily online, and some of Moving Picture World, not the part that I'm interested in now, unfortunately. But some of it's online, and all of Photoplay is online, and... As you and I have talked about before, having the local newspapers online is really great because you can see sometimes the same studio story came out, and each one gives their own little local take on it or something like that. But a lot of times when I'm trying to do these 20s films for which there's very little information, you'll find, lo and behold, some guy in Reading, Pennsylvania, or Indianapolis or something, actually saw the movie before he wrote the review and describes the plot pretty well. So those are just precious because in some cases those kind of local things are about the only thing they have available.
Sure. At any time a movie was shot on location, you'll often find things in the local paper that you won't find anywhere else.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, a lot of times...
just terrific stuff.
In Montana or the Pacific Northwest or something.
Because that's
really
big news for them,
up.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And sometimes they'll even say, and local citizen so-and-so, you know, Mayor and Mrs. So-and-so were in this. And you don't know if they actually made the cut, but just giving that. And sometimes they will even say things like, okay, and then they were on Lake such-and-such, and then they moved over to this forest and whatever. And they're, you know, in those cases, when it's a local paper, they have no reason to make that up. They're just actually telling you, yeah, here's where they went.
So yeah, as you know, I'm a sucker for location stuff. I love to find those. And we have friends up in Napa, and we've talked about making the drive up to Reno, because I've never been there, and I've always heard it's a beautiful place to see. And so I decided, well, when we go up there, I'm gonna do a Margie search. You know, Henry King's Margie?
Yeah, yeah. No, I love that.
And so I went through, last time it showed on Turner Classic Movies, I recorded it, and went through and did freeze frames of everything that shows a location. And on several occasions, they're walking down the street, and there's a street sign. There it is. You tell exactly where the corner is, and then go through the local papers, and they will say, well, the so-and-so home has been remade to look like a mortuary in Margie, and it's at so-and-so. You know, they give you the address, and there it is. So that one's not going to be nearly as much of a challenge to find all the locations, because there are only five or six outdoor locations.
It's a very delightful movie.
It was a wonderful movie. I've often wondered why it's not more highly regarded than it is, because I just love that movie.
I don't think Henry King is as highly regarded as he should be.
My gosh. I did a book on King, taking the oral histories that David Shepherd and Ted Perry did in the 60s and 70s, I guess. And I was turned that into a kind of fake memoir for the Directors Guild. But it was great, great fun. I love his films. And several of them that, for some reason, never got as much note as others, like I'd Climb the Highest Mountain, which is also a terrific one. And in terms of movie locations, shot in northern Georgia and in a place called Helen, Georgia. And when I lived in Atlanta, I did a day where we drove up and found all those places too. And I'm a sucker for that sort of thing.
You know, in the case of Margie, I'm not sure, is that out on DVD? I don't know that ever has, but because I know my niece, who's about 35, I think is 36 now, when she was just in high school, she had seen it on TV, and she said, that's going to be my favorite movie. I love it. So I had gotten a copy from Eddie Brandt or something, and it was not really in very good shape, and then it was on TV, so I was able to record it for her. And it really looks great. I don't know why.
I don't know why either. As a matter of fact, when they showed it on TCM recently, and as we record this is January of 2012, so I guess it was about a month ago, it was pristine, really gorgeous. And
well, you know, years ago, there was some sort of part, I don't know how this happened, but Conrad Janis and his wife did a little event at Paramount in honor of Margie, and Rudy Valley was there, and Jean Crane, and then, gosh, I can't remember her name, the blonde woman who's in it. She was in a lot of Fox for a while.
Yeah.
But never was a big star, but she was in that, and Captain from Castile, and a few things. And a couple of other people from the film were there, and we dressed up in costumes. I was invited because of an article that a guy named Blake Lucas had written for McGill Survey of Cinema, so I gave them Blake's number, and he and his wife came, and I was able to come with my husband. And it was such a treat, and at the time, they had a gorgeous Technicolor print that they showed at Paramount in one of the studios. And it was like, this is in such good, great shape. Why aren't they putting it out? And I don't even think it was out on VHS. I don't remember.
No, it's never been out on video at all.
There must be some.
Yeah. When I worked at Films Inc. in Atlanta, we had a 16mm print of it, so I was able to watch that a few times. And, it's really a shame.
I mean, that's one that we're making a big deal out of, but there's a lot of films like that that are good films that, sadly, people don't know about because they haven't ever come out on DVD. Or VHS even for that.
Yeah, there's a surprising number of good movies. I'm really tickled that Warner Brothers has started doing its archive program where they kind of print on demand all these films that they feel don't have that much of a commercial potential.
Yeah, I've gotten many of those. I've spent many of my hard-earned dollars on it. It is unfortunate that they seem to only have things that were once on VHS.
Mm.
They don't have anything that isn't new, and I'm certainly not criticizing them for doing that, because I think it's a great idea.
But yeah.
There are some films that I know are in there that somebody needs to bring out and...
Well, a couple of them that I've gotten, I mean, obviously as a Wellman guy, I had to get Lafayette Escadrille, which they remastered, and it's in 185, like it would have been, and I've never seen it that way on video, so I'm tickled. And I just got a film called Simon, which I've been looking for years, with Alan Arkin. It was written and directed by Marshall Brickman, and for years, it came out in about 1980, I guess, and I've always wondered, why in the world... has this never come out on video?
They do have a lot of really great silent films, especially like from 28 to 30 and some early 30s things that are really hard to get. So
yeah.
I've really enjoyed seeing a lot of those.
I just wish every studio would do that.
Yeah, and they're pretty economical.
Fox, yeah.
You know, and sometimes they'll have really great sales. So, you know, it would be great if Fox and Columbia would come out with something similar, because, of course, Warner Brothers... has Warner Brothers and MGM and RKO and a bunch of other stuff. But, yeah, it would be nice if they
Well, of course, the treasure trove of movies that's never been available on video is the early 30s Paramount stuff. There's so much great stuff there. And never, I mean, except obviously the Marx Brothers and the Fields movies and things like that. But
well, you get some Kay Francis every once in a while.
Yeah, but just the rank and file random 1932 Paramount film... you're going to be hard-pressed to find it anyway that doesn't show up on TV, and I want all that stuff.
it would be great to have...
all those Charlie Ruggles, Mary Borland movies and everything, there's just tons of them. So so we've come a long way, but we haven't come as long as I want to.
And actually, when we were doing the 50s catalog, I remember there were some films, and we had a really high percentage of films we saw for that. We had, like, 93% of all the films we did, which is a pretty high percent, but there were still films that I remember seeing as a kid, you know, maybe being dragged there by my older brother's sister, that we were not able to get, not just prints. When I say prints, I'm talking about we don't care how you give it to us. You know, we aren't naming names, but we just want to see it for scholarly purposes. And it is a shame, but it's, you know, the further back you go, it's even more true. And sadly, the 70s and beyond even, there's a lot of those films that just don't exist, or they're not existing any place where people are able to find them and see them.
Yeah.
So there really is a lot of work to be done on those kind of things.
Well, especially in the 50s and 60s, you started another troubling thing, is that so many independent filmmakers were making little low-budget movies, and where do you archive those? Who has them, you know? And where do the negatives go? And a lot of that stuff is going away just because of that. I was, because I've written so much about Texas film history, and especially San Antonio film history, there was a filmmaker there named Pat Boyette, who was a newsman and a very gifted cartoonist. But he directed three films between 61 and 63. Two horror films and a war film. And only one of those is known to survive at all. And I looked and looked and looked and asked everybody I knew, and I knew his daughter, and she put me in touch with some other people. And he's been dead for several years, so he was no help. But I finally got put in touch with the editor of the war film. And I said, have any idea where, is there a negative anywhere? Is there a print anywhere? He said, I got a print in my garage.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, oh, yeah? He said, yes, 35 millimeter print. You want it? I said, yes, I do. And he said, okay, I'll send it to you. So he did. And it arrived. I brought it into my living room, which was a mistake. And I opened that can, and I almost died.
Yeah, it was really
gone. It was gone. completely gone to vinegar, completely gummed together, both reels, I mean, all the reels in both cans, just nothing, just a mess. And to my knowledge, that was the single surviving print in the world. And
that is a shame. You know,
I thought I had it, but
when
I didn't.
We were doing the 70s, and they're, you know, still doing that. When I left, I think we'd done through 73, but there were a couple of filmmakers, you know, people who are still alive, or at least they were a couple of years ago, who actually called us and said, do you know where I can get a print of this? And they had no idea. And one actually said, oh, I thought you guys saved everything. No, although we would like to. And actually, my office doesn't handle films at all. We're just researching them. But it is really, really sad that, you know, some of the people, even in the early days, like Mary Pickford or Charlie Chaplin, they knew the value of those things and they saved it. Of course, plenty of other people didn't do that. But
well, Mary Pickford had to be brought around to it, too. She wanted to destroy all of her films.
Oh, did she?
Yeah. And she left word that all of her films should be destroyed because she didn't want to be laughed at by future generations. But
why was she wrong about that?
Luckily, somebody talked some sense into her about that. But yeah,
but it is a shame, especially, like you say, the independent filmmakers.
Yeah.
And so many of those, even, you know, kind of, I don't want to mention any specific companies, but, you know, a certain person who might have produced 20 or 30 or 50 films, and that person died, and who knows what happened to the rights to things, and then, you know, nobody even knows what happened to a lot of those films. And
sometimes they'll be at the film labs and just being stored there, and once the person's died and the storage bills stop getting paid, then out they go. And I don't think I'm alone in worrying about the fact that so many people are shooting on digital now, which I think has a huge danger of just disappearing into the vapor at some point. You know,
I mean, I'm not a film preservation person, but I've been to a lot of the meetings and, you know, AMIA and things like that. And to me, it seems like what the archivists are saying is that if you just have a digital copy, you have no copy. You need to have a print of this thing, otherwise it's going to deteriorate. Because look how, when VHS came out, and I'm sure you, like me, and a number of other people who loved old films, we're just taping things like mad, and then 10 years later it's all flaked off and everything else. And then DVDs came out, and, you know, now we realize that DVDs don't all last forever, too. And with digital files, especially with so many special effects houses and all these different things, you know, who has the complete thing? And it is really, really a problem to only have things digital. So I just think that every new technology sort of sells the public a bill of goods. And I see it even, you know, like in ads for your home movies or things like that. This will never be going away. It's like, no, that's not true. Don't believe them.
Listen.
It's a big lie.
Yeah, when I was writing my Lost Films book, I was interviewing a bunch of archivists, and I was talking with, I apologize, I've forgotten her name, but at the Library of Congress, and at one point we started talking about videotape and the problems therein, in how long would they last. And she said, if it was up to me, I would take all the video and transfer it to nitrate film because it would last a lot longer. And
well, I'm not sure I'd go to nitrate, but yeah, I mean, it is.
Yeah, because it was, it's scary. And then the people who have taken their home movies on 8mm or Super 8 and then have a video copy made of it and then throw the film away.
Yeah, don't throw the film away unless, you know, like a 16, have vinegar syndrome.
Yeah.
But don't throw the film away because that's...
I'm dealing with that now with this this parody of Beaugest that I've told you about that was made by San Diego students in 1939. They shot a 60mm film, and there's only one print because that's all they did. They had the film processed, and they edited that print, and that's what they showed.
That's probably all they could.
That's all there was, yeah. And I guess luckily for me, sometime they had it transferred to video. But now nobody knows where the print is. And the video itself is watchable, but only barely watchable, and it's all we got, but it kills me, because if we had the 60 millimeter print, we could actually do something. We could actually restore that.
Yeah.
And with VHS tape, VHS dupe, you can't do anything with that. You can clean it up to a certain extent, but it's never going to be much better than
it is. Definitely a worry for the future.
Yeah.
How these things are going to go. I mean, even in book preservation, that's a big issue.
Mm-hmm.
Newspapers take up a lot of space, and they do deteriorate more than other things, but you can still find newspapers from the late 1800s that are intact, and maybe they made one microfilm copy, master, and although microfilm is much tougher than motion picture film, it gets all scratched and you can't read some, or it wasn't done very well in the first place or something, and then, you still have to go back to the newspaper, so it does make it...
Yeah, and it still tends to look like a Xerox copy. And I remember when I was writing my book on the Star Film Ranch, the Gaston Melies' movie company in San Antonio, I found two major articles in the San Antonio papers from 1911, and they were filled with pictures. Just filled with pictures that I've never been able to duplicate anywhere else. All those pictures exist only in those papers, and I've never seen anything but bad microfilm copies of them.
Yeah, microfilm does not do well for photographs
at
all. And when you see it online, it's actually kind of even worse, because they scan it, which is a little different process than what they did for the microfilm. So although I love, love, love having these things available, I found, like with Trove, the Australian thing, which is just a marvel. I use that every day, multiple times. But I find myself going to the original that they have rather than their scan thing, because, the original was all smudgy and everything, but it's actually easier to discern what it was than the newer copy, because the scanner makes some sort of decisions, and sometimes it's not the right decision, or it's sort of not very good looking, so you have to look at the other thing. So it is a problem.
But since you've been doing this since the early 80s, just the method of researching film has changed so much in that time. I mean, the archives are still, to me, the number one place to go, but little by little we're actually getting real stuff online. It's
That's
not as much as people think it is, I mean, as far as the primary documents. But
there's still loads of stuff that is not available, unfortunately. And, there are different nonprofits and also different companies that are trying to get a lot of things. But in something like the moving picture world, one of the problems with that, if you've ever used an original moving picture world in the bound copies, they're so tightly bound, and they were huge. It's like every issue was the Bible, or every bound issue, that it's hard to get them. It's like you have to destroy the binding, and most libraries don't want to do that. So maybe in some cases the microfilm might be the only thing available for those. But when we were doing the teens, we had something called the Foster Files, which we called the Foster. A husband and wife named Foster, and I assume they had other assistants, were reviewing films for the military to see whether they were quote-unquote clean pictures to be shown. And they would cut out reviews and news items and things like that, but mostly reviews from papers all over the place and from the trades at the time, exhibitors and Moving Picture World, Motion Picture News, things like that. And so they would type on a scrapbook page what the title was, and they would say approved or not approved or whatever. For many films when we were doing the teens, that was our primary source, those Foster Files. They didn't do every film, or at least we didn't have every film, but they did a heck of a lot of them. And those were great because we actually had the hard copy of that. And sometimes you might not have been able to read the date, but if it was through something that we had a microfilm, we'd be able to check it. But, for many things, we didn't have the funding, and we wouldn't have had the time anyway to go to Peoria or Chicago even, or any place else, to look at local newspapers to see what was available. And even for the 30s, that was true. So now, I'll look something up, and I'll see that the Chicago Tribune is on online, and they had excellent film reviews. And again, very often they would give the whole plot from beginning to end because the guy had actually seen it. Or the LA Times. You know, with the LA Times, if you didn't know when it was reviewed, you couldn't find it.
Yeah.
I think they didn't start their paper indexing until the 70s. So now you can have, there's so much that's available online, which is great. And, you know, Variety's coming online, and or some people have access to it, and more will be having access to it through ProQuest. But it's really great that you can actually do a lot of stuff online. You know, some of it you have to pay for, but it's a real time saver, and it's also great that you can actually, if you need to have a printout, you can print out the whole thing and find it. So the movingimagearchive.org, or, you know, David Pierce's, I mean, they are great. I just love looking at all those things, and I find them so helpful to be able to, you know, the searching might be a little clunky on some things, but you can really zero in on a lot of things for those. So,
yeah
it definitely has changed. You know, like a lot of film historians, as soon as you're done with something, you say, okay, now I want to go back and see where I left off things or make corrections. So you could fill up several lifetimes of doing that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think if I had my way, I would just research and never actually get around to writing anything. Just to,
there's the rub.
Yeah. You usually have to end up, oh, well, I got to write this book after all. But
that was one of the hard things, you know, in the catalog. I was sort of supposed to be the person in charge in terms of managing as well as directing the research, and I, like everybody else in the catalog, but, you know, you get 10 different people, and at least half of them are perfectionists. And they want to keep doing more and more. And you have to say, at a certain point, we just have to stop. You know, we can't get everything. And it was very frustrating, especially in the 30s, that so many films we saw then, and because we didn't have Turner Classic Movies or even AMC when it used to be an old movie thing, and or videotape even for some of those early things, one person had one shot to see it at UCLA or Library of Congress or someplace like that.
Wow.
And so, you know, we couldn't always have our best man, so to speak, on this, or the person who had all the photos and things like that. We just didn't have all those sources. So, you know, people complain and say, oh, how could you miss so-and-so in this film? It's like, okay, I've heard people say, I've seen it 30 times and I finally spotted Carol Lombard or something like
that. Yeah.
I think it's excellent. But on the other hand, you know,
yeah, we saw it
we
once.
Had a limited amount of money and a little amount of time, so it is sort of difficult. And, you know, now being sort of semi-retired, I have the leisure to, like, oh, watch this film again. Oh, yeah, here's so-and-so and here's so-and-so. And I'll just sort of add that. That's the beauty of
Well, how does that work, being semi-retired? Are you just, do you just work on the catalog when you feel like it? Or do you have a
Well, I have other things.
Certain
like,
schedule?
I do, I do other freelancing. But because I'm the kind of person who needs to have a disciplined schedule for myself, I usually, unless I have a big freelancing thing that I, you know, deadline that I have to finish for somebody else, you know, I spend basically about 3 hours or so every day, and I have a schedule. I'm trying to go through all the 20s, kind of going backwards, but I'm in 26 right now. And, you know, check all the, in the 20s, unfortunately, they didn't do the reviews. They didn't cite reviews, so try and get the basics of, you know, Variety, Film Daily, New York Times. And sometimes I get other things. And if it looks like a pretty full record and I've checked everything and it looks like it's okay, I have to go on to the next thing. I'm trying to get as much as I can of those films that any people listening to this who use a catalog and see in the 20s know where information about this plot has been found. So I've found many of those things, sometimes in small-town newspapers or sometimes in archival settings, or sometimes it's just available now. You know, a lot of things are available either online or on DVD or whatever. So I do try and set a schedule for myself to do it, and then whenever I can, and I've collected quite a few silent films on DVD, to watch them and sort of completely catalog them, or I'll see some. Saw a wonderful film a couple of months ago called Sorrel and Son at the Academy, which really blew me away. It was just a wonderful film. So I really felt great about, you know, writing the new summary and giving a nice note and so forth that. But it's a really time-consuming thing, and I find as I'm getting into the earlier years of the 20s, there's such a huge number of quickie Western kind of things for which there's very little information, yeah. Or these people like Reed Howes, people who've made maybe 30 or 40 films in the space of about a year, and same director, same supporting cast, it's very hard in some cases to tell which was one or the other.
Yeah.
I've been using a lot of British and Australian reviews because sometimes they had more information there than is available to me now. And I found that sometimes they get it confused. Like they would, in England, they would change the title a lot. In Australia, for some reason, they didn't, which is nice. But, you know, there might be a Yakima Canuck Western. Maybe he made three or four Westerns with roughly the same plot, and they kind of got it confused. So you're trying to kind of decipher sure. the things there. So it's not going to be perfect, but I'm trying to do whatever I can. It's a labor of love. I could spend all of my time doing it, but I do have to do other things while.
Yeah, there are all sorts of those little companies in the 20s, too. So when I was doing my San Antonio book, Texas Hollywood, I found all sorts of companies that came and set up studios in San Antonio in the 20s, or even from 1918 on. And the local papers were really all I could ever find about those things. And when I came through the regular channels, when I went through Moving Picture World or Variety or any of that stuff of the time, I didn't find anything about any of that stuff. So it's
that's true even for some of the ones made in Hollywood. I mean, when I used to be working at AFI, I would, you know, go down Beverly and go up Gower or something like that. And some of those buildings, the actual buildings are still there.
Mm-hmm.
They're different companies, but it's like, wow, if I'd only known that this is where Excellent Pictures was or Inspiration or Sierra or some of these other ones. Like, you know, if those walls could talk, I could really get some good information out of some of these people. And so it is very frustrating.
Yeah.
And sometimes I just have to say, look, I could spend another week doing this, but unless I hop on a plane or, you know, do whatever, you simply can't do it. I should mention that Bob Burchard's adding a lot of short films, and he's doing a lot of stuff in the catalog. You know, he's the current editor of the catalog. But I'm trying to, because I'm sort of a plotter, I'm trying to scientifically go year by year, just go through every single film title and see how it needs to be updated, and where I can really try and do a good job.
But yeah.
I figured if I can keep my sanity and so forth for a while, I should be able to finish the entire decade.
Yeah. Be more like me and just don't worry about your sanity.
Yeah.
It'll take care of itself. Well, I probably kept you talking for way too long anyway, so we should cut it short.
Well,
too late for that.
Yeah. I certainly enjoyed it, and I hope I didn't ramble.
No. I could stay here for another hour. I love talking to you, as we've had many lunches and just talked about this sort of thing. So we'll come back and do a part two one of these days.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to.
So consider yourself warned.
Okay.
So, Pat, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Pat Hansen. I know I enjoyed the first time around, and I enjoyed listening to it again today, as I did. Not the same time you were listening to it, of course, because how could I know that? But the day that I'm recording, why do we have to get so technical about this stuff? Just infer my meaning, will you? I want to thank everybody who had a hand in getting the commentary track up again. The wondrous announcer, Claire McCullough Thompson. The designer of my website, thecommentarytrack.com, James Hutchins, who is also doing my personal website at the moment. And it's not quite ready to go yet, but once it is, I'll give you that URL as well. And you can find some really peculiar things that don't really go on the Commentary Track website. But for my own personal one, would be just fine. Also, obviously, want to thank once again, Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for my terrific theme music, In and Out. I love all that they have written for me, and it's a great pleasure for me to be able to present this music each and every week. And I want to thank you, the listener. Why? Because you're listening. And Also, because you're not only listening, you're going to iTunes and you're giving me great ratings and positive reviews so that other people can be drawn. You are doing that, aren't you? I'm not just hoping, am I? You're really doing that, aren't you? You're going to iTunes and giving me great ratings, aren't you? Because you should feel really guilty if you're not. Really bad about yourself. I'm not saying you're a bad person. I'm just saying you're doing a bad thing. So, make everything right. Become a good person and go to iTunes and give me a great rating. You can also listen to the commentary track, obviously, from the website, and I hope you'll go there, thecommentarytrack.com. Don't forget to put the in there, thecommentarytrack.com. I leave Amazon links for all of my guests so that you can find their books and videos and what have you. There's a page each of just my personal movies and books so that you can buy them either directly from me if I have copies and directly from Amazon if I don't have copies. So I hope that you will go through and look through some of those, because I would love to sell you some books. And the ones that I do have copies, there's just a PayPal link. And so you can send me a note when you buy it, and I will autograph it or whatever. I'll even sign some other author's name if that's what you prefer, because I want you, the customer, to be happy. So I hope you'll go there, buy lots of books and videos, DVDs. And then Amazon will give me a little bit of a kickback, and we can help keep this thing a-going just a little bit longer, and that would be very nice. I also have, and I know this is incredibly optimistic, but a couple of people have done this. I have a donate button that just allows you to go to PayPal and just donate a little bit to help keep me going. And that is wonderful. As I say, that's happened on two occasions so far, and I am most grateful to those kind and wonderful people. So that's what you can do in the meantime, and I hope you'll be back with me next week when we'll have another great commentary track guest. And I like to leave it a little bit mysterious. You know how it is. It's kind of a cliffhanger. So meet me back next week, the same time and same iTunes station. And until then, don't worry. We're going to fix it in post.